In the nation's northwest corner is Washington, an evergreen playground blessed by an unusual variety of natural attractions.
And it is time once again for All Over the Map with Felix Spinell, our resident historian. A quick look at the stories behind the names of local places. And this week, the local place is Pullman. But the story is about the origins of Wazoo's cougar mascot, which is celebrating its centennial this month.
Yeah, and to celebrate the auspicious occasion, a new temporary exhibit about the history of the school's previous mascots, as well as the various iterations of the cougar over the past century, is now on display at the main library there on campus until early November. Marco English, he's an archivist with WSU, he created the exhibit. Had a wide-ranging phone conversation with him yesterday. He demonstrated his mastery of cougar mascot folklore and proved that he's a good sport. I'm here just a few of the highlights. I talked to him for a long time. Before they were the Cougars, some unofficial names used by sports writers for the team were the Farmers, the Aggies, or the Potato Diggers.
Mm-hmm.
That's Mark's favorite.
That's intimidating.
There were also some good luck dog mascots, including Squirt and Billy. And there's pictures of Squirt at My Northwest. Now, Squirt was the dog that was stolen by Oregon State supporters in Corvallis in 1905. And so WSC, remember this was Washington State College in those days, WSC players raided the campus and kidnapped a black bear named Toodles. Now they dressed Toodles in a crimson jacket and paraded him around the field. Now Squirt was found in pretty short order, but the WSC players kept Toodles too, and they took him back on the train to Pullman, and then where he stayed for 3 years.
Wait, but how do you kidnap a bear?
Well, this was the old days where black bears were tamer, and they were more readily, it was more common to have black bear mascots were almost everywhere in the Northwest. Some
really?
Schools or Navy ships or whatever have black bears as mascots.
People and you were, are talking about Corvallis.
Yeah, yeah, there was probably several to choose from. Toodles was just probably one of the bears they could have picked from. Okay, so by 1919, official mascots were becoming much more common, and there was an effort to choose one for Washington State. On October 25th, 1919, the team went down to California to play the Golden Bears. Washington State was expected to lose, but they actually won the game handily. California sports writers described the upset victory as a, quote, cougar mauling the Golden Bears, and a mascot was born.
Ah.
The student body made it official a few days later on October 28th, and for the game against Idaho on November 1st, 1919, they had a big Cougars banner. And for good measure, they had two taxidermied cougars on wheeled carts, which, coincidentally, we also have pictures of at My Northwest. Now, being the tough, fair-minded historian and quasi-journalist that I try to be, I had to ask Marco English about the origins of Tecougat. He told me that a Spokane sports writer named John Blanchette gets the credit and the blame. He was inspired to come up with a phrase by an October 26, 1985 game against Arizona State that the Cougars dominated most of the way but then ultimately collapsed and lost. Now, Mark O. English has an interesting interpretation of what it means to coug it.
To me, to coug something, you already have to have been doing great, and something goes horribly awry at the end. So if you're cougin', you're already ahead of the game. I kind of look at it that way.
So, you know, I mean, I give the guy credit. That's pretty creative. I like that. So, you know, archivists are like historians or journalists. You have to look at both sides of the picture. You have to dig into these tough questions, so... That's what he did. And the Cougars' mascot name is actually, his name is Butch.
Uh-huh.
He could have been named Roland. Our governor, Roland Hartley, gave a live cougar to WSU back in the 20s, and they were going to name it after him, but he knew he had to run for re-election across the whole state, so he said, no, call him something else. So they named it after Herbert Butch Meeker, who was the quarterback then. Butch was he was 5'3", 135 pounds, the son of a butcher, so that's where he got the nickname Butch. And that's why that big-headed mascot you see, the guy in a costume, he's also Butch the Cougar, too, harking back to that quarterback from the 1920s.
But, again, originally, the mascot was chosen to represent overwhelming, unstoppable victory.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, very good. And 100 years ago this month.
Very good. Thank you, Felix.
Thanks.
Are we going to talk about our play?
Our play?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
How could
In
we
addition
forget?
To being our resident historian, Felix Spinell is also our resident radio play playwright and director. So when is it happening?
It's on Tuesday, October 29th. It's 8 o'clock. It's at Town Hall, Seattle. It's live on the radio.
How do you like this from your diva star? He doesn't even know when it is.
No,
that's good. This is the beauty of radio. We could do the play tomorrow if we had to.
I think Jim Dever is the star this year.
Yeah, but it's mynorthwest.com/events. Tickets, fun for the whole family.
Are we rehearsing?
Sorry, wrong number.
Next
Tuesday. Yeah, it's this Tuesday morning.
And
you, I told you before, you play Waldo Evans, probably the sleeper character of the whole thing. It seems like a minor role, but really you're the pivotal guy. You're like the
that's what every director's
you're like
me.
The Ambassador Sundland.
That's what every yeah, oh, great. Thank you.
Am I playing the earnest, kind young lady again?
Or a starlet or ingenue or something like that.
Know.
Yeah.
Something very like good. That. It's very far from my comfort zone.
You're playing I'm playing a sleeper character and you're playing something like that. Spoken like a director.
We know who the star is.
Yeah. Too many details. Too early. It's only October, what is it, 18th?
Yeah, whatever. Thank you, Felix. All the Felix speeches, by the way, are on MyNorthwest.com. Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colin O'Brien. Here's Hannah Scott. Justin Herb. What is that? That's Dallas Cowboys.
It is the Dallas Cowboys.
Are they not even playing the Seahawks this week?
No, they actually aren't playing the Seahawks at all this entire season, but they do need some help, so
I
wore my
jersey. Is that
the
only jersey you have? Is that the deal?
No, I have four. Well, that team, yes, but I have multiple.
So the showdown over $30 card tabs. Initiative 976 sponsor Tim Iman faced off against the State Senate Transportation Chair last night in a debate. You going to tell us who won?
You know what? I don't know that you could say who won one way or the other. I think the idea here was this was hosted by the Everett Herald to just kind of try to flesh out some truths about this before voters have the say on their ballot, right? Ballots are coming in the mail this week, and it's going to be up to the voters to decide whether or not they want $30 car tabs, kind of having a big impact on transportation projects across the state. This debate started with Tim Iman pointing out that the outdated vehicle valuation system that came with Sound Transit 3 to calculate car tabs was a problem.
The valuation system that we have is so fraudulent that the voters voted against it and repealed it in 1999. They repealed it again in 2002. Yet, like a character in the movie, in the TV show Walking Dead, it's just basically resurrected itself. And it's the same valuation system that the voters have voted twice against. And for the last 2.5 years, our elected officials haven't done anything about it.
And for him, the bottom line was?
You already pay a huge sales tax when you buy that vehicle. You're already paying one of the highest gas taxes in the nation when you use the vehicle. It's simply not fair for them to triple taxes on a dishonest tax when you're already paying more than your fair share with all the other taxes that you're paying. So this is the question that we're going to be asking over and over again throughout this debate. Is this a dishonest tax? And I challenge my other side to answer that question.
The State Senate Transportation Chair Steve Hobbs came back with the laundry list of impacts to transportation if this initiative were to pass.
$300 to $400 million hit to the transportation budget, $700 million hit yearly to Sound Transit. We're not even talking about defeasement of bonds and the penalties you have to pay. So it's more than that. And the $60 million affecting our communities across the state from Wapato to Yakima to Granite Falls. Transportation benefit districts that benefit their communities that they decided on their own.
Did he answer the what Tim asked him to answer, which is it an unfair tax?
He
tax was passed illegally.
And he didn't initially. Here's what he wanted to say as far as setting the record straight. Because Iman came back after that and said, you didn't answer the question.
Yeah.
He pointed out the cuts here are going to have to be made, this and that. Iman ended up pushing on what we've heard before is that if this were to pass and there are cuts to transportation, there's this $3.4 billion surplus that can be used. So Hobbs fired back at that and then got into the, which he said that wasn't true. There was only $1.7 billion and it's rainy day fund that should go for other things and it would be irresponsible for them to use that. On whether this is a dishonest tax, this is what he had to say.
The Sound Transit and several newspapers had a calculator out there that told you exactly what you were going to get. Now, if you look at ST3, the funding there, and look at the average increase, it was $100 from the ST3 portion of the tab.
So not a straight yes or no answer, but basically mm-hmm. the information was out there and 700,000 voters approved this. It basically that his belief, as many in the legislature say, everybody knew what they were voting for. Yeah.
So Hobbs was very reluctant to talk about the tax side, huh?
He just a little bit. He didn't say yes or no whether this was a dishonest tax. I can say that.
Okay, now for Iman, was Iman willing to talk about the effects on transportation? Does he care?
It's not about that. He said he's not about anti-rail. He cares about the tax portion of this.
Does not care about the consequences of taking this away. This is, because in 1999, they did exactly what he said. They of course, passed the tab thing, and then they used the surplus to backfill. And the result was, how many years of undone maintenance do we have right now?
A ton, and we went 15 years without having an actual construction budget and the legislature.
Right.
Yeah.
And
so there were consequences to that.
Right. And that was Steve Hobbs' point. He said it would be absolutely wholly irresponsible for us to do that. And there's not as much money as you say that there is to begin with.
And as far as Washington taxpayers being overtaxed, did he point out that Washington actually, if you look at the tax foundation, is right in the middle of the states? It is not by far, it is not the highest tax state.
I did not hear that come up.
We also have no income tax in case, though. I know there are people trying, but we also have no income tax.
We don't.
That out, or was that left out, too?
No, the only thing I heard was from Iman was that we can expect a capital gains tax and things like that to be coming up again in this next session, that this we're overtaxed as a whole. Kind of the same things you tend to hear.
We can expect the cap to be passed?
They'll definitely bring it up.
I believe it's a long way from being passed. Although I will acknowledge a lot of people are pushing very hard to get one.
And I wouldn't be surprised if you saw something come up on an income tax separately.
It'll definitely come up.
Yeah, there's more momentum.
Coming up and passing are two very different things.
Agreed. And he's just basically saying, look, we're paying for is this little $30 sticker that goes on the back of your car. And then the other side's point is, no, this is about maintaining our roads and things like that.
No, Iman didn't really say that's the cost of the sticker, did he?
That's exactly what he said. He said $30 to cover the cost of the sticker is what we need to be paying. That's it.
The sticker costs $30?
Is enough to cover that, is what he said. Anything, these hundreds of dollars don't need to be charged. I do want to point out that Everett Mayor Cassie Franklin was also part of this debate, and she weighed in on the elimination of transportation benefit districts and how bad that would decimate her city transportation budget, potholes leading to long-term, more expensive road repairs down the line that would hurt your vehicle and make you have to pay more because of your own vehicle maintenance.
The reason stamps cost whatever they cost is because of the cost of printing that little stamp?
I don't know.
I don't think so.
I don't know. Here's what I know. I'm a person listening to this trying to decide which way to vote. I'm not sure that I got any clarity one way or the other. So you're going to have your transportation backers who vote one way, I think. And then there are people, and I tweeted live about this last night. I had a lot of feedback, all of it from people who are upset with the car tax.
Yeah, I have no doubt about that. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Hannah Scott, Turkey, and the clash with the Kurds. Shelling and some gunfire continue in northern Syria despite President Trump's announcement of a pause in the fighting arranged with the president of Turkey. We called up Face the Nation host Margaret Brennan for an explanation.
It's not a ceasefire. The U.S. negotiator who brokered this, Ambassador Jim Jeffries, said that on the record in a briefing with reporters yesterday. In the official documents, it's not even called a ceasefire. It is a pause in firing from Turkey. They can still fire back for defensive purposes, but they're supposed to hold their fire basically so the U.S. allies can retreat. This is a negotiated retreat. It is not an end to fighting. It is not a peace deal. It is not good for humanity writ large, as the president said. He overbilled this yesterday, as did the vice president, in saying that this was a tremendous accomplishment brokered through friendship between the two world leaders. The U.S. still has this threat hanging over the Turks, although they've already promised the president and the vice president to pull back the U.S. sanctions. Officially, the document that was negotiated said sanctions would only be officially removed after 5 days if Turkey only fires for defensive purposes and not actually slaughtering the Kurds and people on the ground. So this is completely tenuous, and it does not in any way do anything to increase U.S. influence. In fact, if you look at the ground, it is Russian, Turkish, and Iranian-backed forces in the Assad regime who are advancing faster than the U.S. can retreat. That is why the United States bombed its own equipment 2 days ago.
Okay, if we're not fighting other people's wars, what does this mean for our alliance with Israel?
Well, the Israelis, and this is one of the reasons why you have Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Vice President Mike Pence in Israel today, is to reassure them, specifically Benjamin Netanyahu, who raised the term and his concern of ethnic cleansing in Kurdish territory. When you look at that framing and you have a U.S. ally say, wait a second, you sold those people out, what's going to stop you from selling me out? When you have the President of the United States repeatedly tell the world the U.S. does not want to be fighting, period, what does that mean in terms of pulling back military influence? And it's interesting because while you do hear a number of Republicans objecting to the president's posturing here, if you look at the Democratic candidates right now, you even had Elizabeth Warren on the debate stage this week say she wanted to pull U.S. troops out of the Middle East. This idea of an American withdrawal somehow resonates with people when they hear the phrase endless wars.
Yeah.
That is not what U.S. troops were doing. That very small footprint of about 1,000 people were advising and assisting local forces and trying to stop this blow up. Was it, a long-term proposition safe for American forces? Probably not. But the quick withdrawal was not either.
The other thing that happened this week was the president's chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, admitting that his boss committed an impeachable offense using executive power to punish a rival, and then like within an hour, he denied what he had clearly said on tape and which has now been repeated over and over again. So what the heck? What's going on?
Yes, you had the Department of Justice and the president's own personal attorneys issuing statements trying to distance themselves from what Mick Mulvaney, the acting chief of staff, said from the White House podium on camera yesterday, which was essentially, so what? This happens all the time, and this is just going to be standard to have political influence in foreign policy. And he directly linked the president's request for an investigation into Democrats. He said the president wanted to know where this server was. The president continues to believe this debunked conspiracy theory that there's a hidden server in Ukraine that once belonged to the Democratic National Committee that might have emails hidden on it. Again and again, some of the president's advisors have told them that's not legitimate. It's a conspiracy theory, but he continues to believe it. And Mick Mulvaney said from the podium that the president directly linked that. He wanted the Ukrainians to investigate it. And that's one of the reasons why military aid was withheld. That was red meat for investigators on Capitol Hill. It was a headache for Republican allies of the president who have said throughout that this was not actually what the president was seeking. So Mick Mulvaney confirmed a lot of what the president was being accused of. And then after the fact said, no, the media made it up, even though, as you say, it's on tape.
Margaret Brennan, host of Face the Nation. Cairo film critic Tom Tiny just materialized in a poof of purple smoke. I've never understood why the smoke was necessary. Anyway, I know there are those of you who consider him to be the villain on the Tom and Curly show, but that's just because you haven't explored his complicated backstory. And he has our Friday film review, which is Maleficent, the Mistress of Evil.
That's right, Dave. Twice upon a time. Maleficent, Mistress of Evil, Dave, extends the origin story set forth in the 2014 live-action smash hit Maleficent, which cleverly upended our understanding of the greatest of Disney's animated villains. Not at all the malevolent evildoer depicted in Sleeping Beauty, Angelina Jolie's Maleficent turns out to be a wronged woman seeking justice for herself and her people. Climaxing with an ingenious spin on the true love's kiss requirement to awaken the Sleeping Beauty Aurora, the 2014 version ends with order restored between the human and fairy worlds. Maleficent proclaims young Aurora queen of the Moors, that's fairyland, and she settles into a role as godmother and unofficial mother figure. Now, 5 years have elapsed when the sequel begins, and the peace and quiet is about to be disturbed again. By impending nuptials, Maleficent, for one, is not pleased.
I have a little bit of news.
Well, on with it.
Prince Philip has,
disappeared.
No, Philip has...
Yellow fever? No, wait. Leprosy.
No, mistress. Prince Philip has asked Aurora if she'll become his...
Don't. Ruin my morning.
Peace may have reigned between the humans and the fairy world, but it's been an unsteady peace, Dave, with human poachers kidnapping fairy woodland creatures and Maleficent going after the poachers. So she's less than thrilled that Aurora fancies human royalty, Prince Philip.
Godmother, Philip asked me to marry him. Poor thing. He'll recover. My answer was yes. No. Yes. No, I wasn't really asking, nor was I.
Maleficent is not the only one bothered by the pairing. Philip's mother, played by Michelle Pfeiffer, abhors Maleficent. Witness her icy greeting at a family get-together dinner for the young couple.
You have done an admirable job going against your own nature to raise this child. But now she will finally get the love of a real mother. Tonight, I consider Aurora...
Things go from bad to worse at this dinner. Not only is the wedding called off in spectacular fashion, but Maleficent is attacked and war breaks out between humans and fairies. Now, against the backdrop of an impending war, Aurora must decide between the fairy world, represented by her godmother, and humanity, represented by her mother-in-law, to be. Likewise, Maleficent must choose sides between her own kind and her human goddaughter. These dilemmas animate the rest of the film. Now, Angelina Jolie was born to play Maleficent, and she cuts a very fine figure once again with her high-necked capes, twisty black horns, and killer cheekbones. Deadpan humor also becomes her, as when she's challenged by the evil queen.
If I didn't know better, I'd say we're making a threat.
Well, do you?
Do I what?
Know better.
And when she, with all her mystical powers at her disposal, confronts a motley rabble of angry peasants, she just dismisses them.
Pitchforks. Humans are hilarious.
Humans are hilarious.
They actually come out with pitchforks?
Yes, they do.
It's been so done.
Yes. Hey, it's a fairy tale. Come on. What have pitchforks and peasants not doing in a fairy tale? Her wry delivery lifts the sometimes grim mood of much of the film, as do the frequent and clever riffs on the original Sleeping Beauty. And strains of humor can even be found in the classic familial tensions between mother and daughter, between daughter and mother-in-law, and between mother and mother-in-law. A black humor parody of how fraught weddings can be, perhaps? And finally, this being a fairy tale, the clouds of war, deception, and death do eventually depart, and happiness is bestowed upon us all. Even the so-called mistress of evil bows to love.
Well, spoiler. is there any discussion of what happens, I mean, what the nature of the offspring are when you have a human fairy marriage?
Yeah, you know, they really don't get into that. That's an excellent point. And that's why there'll probably be a Maleficent 3 to figure out what this
kind of... So the kid is sort of a fairy down to the waist, and then below the waist is human?
Don't you get that Shrek?
Yeah, it could be. They do not go that far. It is true, though, that Maleficent looks a lot human, even though she has wings and can fly around. But, yeah, I think that's a good question. We'll have to see what the baby looks like.
Yes. So how many tangs for Maleficent, Mr. Sidney?
I happily give it 3 tangs out of 4.
There we go. Thank you, Tom.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness. 9 months ago, Jay Mitchell hit bottom, but credits a group of fifth grade students for lifting him up.
Because I was in a really dark place. I didn't have hope. Their hope is what got me through.
9 months ago, Jay lost his construction job to a hip injury, his home to eviction, and then his wife to cancer. All he had left was his black Labrador named Hero. Both were living on the streets in Mendota Heights, Minnesota. Temperatures were 30 below overnight. And despite being offered shelter for the night, he refused to leave his dog. Dogs weren't allowed in the shelter. So he stayed with him. And that loyalty cost Jay parts of both of his feet to frostbite. But then kids from the nearby visitation school heard his story.
We saw the story, and we really felt like he needed some support.
So they huddled together with their teacher.
As a teacher, we talk a lot about kindness. We study it. We read about it. I think these kids really took that and ran with it.
And they sent him cards with messages of hope.
Thank you for showing me that fear can't get in the way of passion. Jay, we are praying for you.
And that's exactly what Jay needed.
We all need a recharge, every human being, if they're going through a traumatic tough time, and I didn't know where mine was going to come from, and the Lord did it through a fifth grade class.
And October 4th, Care 11 News was there as Jay met those students face to face for the first time to thank them. And what they did on that day, October 4th, is they organized a special day for Jay and Hero, because St. Francis is the patron saint of animals, and his day is October 4th. So they were able to offer Hero a blessing.
It is 7:38. Chris, your traffic headline.
Still working with the remnants of this car fire response on eastbound 512 getting into Puyallup. I'll tell you about it coming up next.
This is Cairo Radio.
Fun. Here's where the future of the first date is going. Virtual reality.
What is wrong with you?
It's time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And now here he is in his first on-air appearance since declaring he's now okay with A-Rod, Danny O'Neill. So we face what the Seattle Times described as the blitz-happy Baltimore Ravens, but we get Jaron Reed back from suspension, so that should work, right?
It should. These are two teams known for their defense. If you ask people to name the top NFL defenses over the past 10 years, you're probably not getting to 5 without naming both of these teams. They've been really good. They're two of the better offenses in the league this year, which is really strange, and with two of the more dynamic quarterbacks. But I do think it's going to be defense that decides this game. I think it's going to be defense, and whether it is the Ravens able to disrupt the Seahawks, Earl Thomas coming back to Seattle, or whether it's Seattle finally getting a pass rush together with Jaron Reed returning. He's an interior lineman. Usually those guys aren't great pass rushers. He's a force, though. So this will be, I think it's a game where the weaknesses of the two teams, whichever team's weakness turns out to be stronger than the other team's weakness, is going to be the decisive factor.
Remind me, what did Jaron Reed do to become suspended?
He violated the personal conduct policy. There was an incident at his house involving a woman who alleged that he had assaulted her.
Oh.
And I believe he broke through a door. It wasn't someone he was living with, so people have called it a domestic violence incident. And not to say this wasn't serious, but this wasn't a domestic violence incident. Mm-hmm. It wasn't someone he was living with, but there was an altercation involving a woman. There had been a fight involving another woman between the two of them, and it was a mess. He was never arrested, but he ended up being investigated for it, and the police were called. And after the NFL looked into it, they decided to suspend it. In this case, an incident that may not have warranted criminal proceedings, but wasn't the kind of behavior that the NFL has decided it will tolerate. You certainly leave the team vulnerable, but I always feel that coaches come at that from the perspective of how does this affect me and my team, as opposed to where it situates. Coaches mean very well. I don't know how much influence they have over protecting and controlling the behavior of all of their teammates.
How does that affect the locker room vibe? I'm just trying to think, if I was working next to somebody who had that sort of hanging over his head, you know, what would I, how would I act? What would I say?
People don't mention it.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, that's the general policy. I don't think players necessarily get mad at each other when they get in trouble. But they certainly don't condone the behavior.
Yeah.
So I think that it's largely not mentioned. And hey, that's a decision he made, and he's an adult, and he's accountable for the consequences of the situation that he created.
So what is our weakness? You said this will be whoever has the bigger weakness.
There's two things. The defense, Seattle's defense has been fairly bad, but so has Baltimore's. Both teams are allowing more than 6 yards of play. Seattle's special teams has also been a concern. There's been a 75-yard kickoff return. This last week, there was a punt return for a touchdown. It's been a problem. Their punter's been below average this season. Dixon was so good last year. He's not this year. And the kicker's caused a little bit of concern for me. Are you guys aware of my spoiled milk theory with kickers?
That they wear out after a while?
The second time you have to sniff to see it, if it's good, they need to be thrown out. You're allowed one sniff. I haven't sniffed the milk yet, but I have checked the date. The date says it should still be good. Even though I kind of taste it.
Well, no, you're talking about what? What is it, 2 weeks ago? I mean,
Well, you missed an extra point last week.
Well,
he's
it was
two
the wind.
Goals
it, was,
this year.
It was windy.
Yeah, okay. I haven't sniffed yet, but it's been six games, and he's missed three kicks and bounced another one off an upright.
This theory didn't work with Hauschka. He left and became great again.
That's true. But it's better to err on the side of throwing the milk out and failing to get sick than having
it?
Magical recovery milk.
I thought special teams won games.
But that's exactly why you have to throw the milk out if it's suspect. We stuck with Blair Walsh at Costas Games. We stuck with Sebastian Janikowski. You see what happened to him?
Well, yeah.
That was really old milk. That was old enough milk that it was possibly fermented. I mean, it was disgusting.
It was cottage cheese.
And what happened at the end of the first half against the Cowboys? He hurt himself kicking. It's the only time I've seen a kicker hurt himself on the one thing. He's a unitasker. One job. He hurt himself doing the one job he was hired to do.
I see. In other words, we're just a few years away from having a machine do it, is what you're saying.
No, because then that's not any fun. You got to have the kicker to make
just
fun of.
Wheel out the little kicking machine. See whose machine is
so
better.
Bad. If our engineers are better than your engineers.
Yeah, that's it.
what would you say about maybe getting almond milk instead of regular milk? That will last longer. Right?
Yeah.
Who would
Does
be
the
almond the milk
nutrients?
Of kickers? Yeah, sure.
I've got almond milk right now. I live in a household with one lactose tolerant person and one person who doesn't tolerate it so well. I've got all sorts of varieties. Milk's still the best thing for kicking, though.
Yeah.
An almond milk kicker is one who just skitters it along the ground. Doesn't even get in the air. So what is your prediction? What's the score going to be for Sunday's game at CenturyLink?
The Seahawks, they're going to score 32 points.
Mm-hmm.
And the Ravens are going to score 23.
32-23. Danny O'Neill from 710 ESPN Seattle. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. There is an abundant amount of advice out there about how to limit your child's screen time, but I thought we would ask Allie. Allie Sokolow, licensed mental health counselor, sponsored by ProClub, the region's premier health club and wellness destination. So, first of all, what's your understanding of the latest studies of young children and screen time? If you, for example, let your infant play with your iPhone, is it going to damage them for life?
I don't think it's going to damage them for life, but I think it's good to have boundaries around time spent on the phone and how much access parents have to the phone to teach our kids that they don't need to be connected all the time. And also so parents have an idea about what's going on their kids' phones.
So when's the first time you would introduce a child to this kind of technology?
Little kids are exposed to it very, very young, and they see their parents on their iPhones. They're curious about what's on them. But to have their own phone is sort of a different issue. Obviously, kids playing on their parents' cell phone is very different than having your kid have their own phone.
Now, when the child grows up and they've got their own phone, they're using it for various things. When can you discern that maybe it's hurting them? We hear that the millennial generation, I was just talking to my daughter, she says, Dad, did you know my generation is the unhappiest generation there? And you certainly hear stories about kids reading about themselves on their phones and getting depressed. Are there early warning signs a parent should look for?
Yeah, it's interesting, actually. I went to a conference about kids and anxiety, and they're saying that kids have a lot more anxiety because what's happening is they're getting on social media and they are in fight or flight mode. And fight or flight mode is our body's response to stress. So we shouldn't be in that state for very extended amounts of time. And kids are in it for the whole time they're on there. So if you're seeing your kids with higher anxiety levels, they may be too addicted to their phones.
It occurs to me, how do you even, I don't think when my kids were growing up, I would have noticed the difference between a dangerous level of repression and just normal teenage sulking. How do you tell the difference?
I think that what you'll see is that you can't get them away from their phones. Teenagers sulk, and that's very normal and all the things. But you see kids on their phones. They can't stay away from them. They have them at the dinner table. They get upset if they're away from their phones, if they miss a call from somebody. And hindsight's always 20/20, right? But it always helps to set rules and boundaries around phones before the kid gets the phone. But what's happening is parents are giving their kids phones for safety reasons, and then once their kids are addicted, they're trying to make rules then. And so what I talk to parents about is like, what's ideal is that you would have had rules first, but make sure like the kids know that their phone has to be off during the school time. Anytime you call them, they have to answer the phone. You take the phone from them maybe when they get home from school so they can sit down and do their homework without being distracted. Make sure that you're charging their phone in your room every night so they're not tempted to be on their phone looking through Facebook, looking through Instagram in the middle of this night instead of sleeping. And so be really diligent about taking that phone away from them.
So they charge their phones in your room.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm.
And at what age would you start setting the rules like this?
Right out of the gate. So if you decide that you want to give your child a phone at 10 years old, fine, but let's make sure that we establish those rules right away. And then as the child gets older and you can see they're being more responsible, maybe those loosen up a little bit. But I think the stricter the rules at the beginning, the better it will go.
So you're telling me that there are kids who at the age of 10 will say, Mom, Dad, here's my phone to be charged for the night.
If that's the rule, because the parents can say, we'll buy you a phone. I think it's a great idea. It's great for safety, but you have to do this for us to get the phone. And if you're not going to be doing that, then we're going to take the phone away.
All right. I like it.
Yeah. There's a great website called Youth First. It's youthfirstinc.org. And there's a whole section on setting boundaries for kids with cell phones.
Very good. Allie Sokolow, licensed mental health counselor. Allie, thank you.
Thank you.
So there it is. If you're a parent, quid pro quo, perfectly legal. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.